Campus FM presents a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled An Applied Anthropologist Among Engineers, Social Impact Assessment in a Big Industry Project. This talk is delivered by Dr. Kathy Baldwin.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, radio audience. Welcome back to the 17th annual Work in Progress in the Social Studies seminar series. And tonight, on a increasingly warm April 2nd evening, we are very happy to have from the University of Oxford, Dr. Kathy Baldwin. Kathy Baldwin is an anthropologist who is giving a paper in the domain of applied anthropology. And her paper is entitled An Applied Anthropologist Among Engineers, Integrating Social Science into Health Impact Assessment in a UK Industrial Project. Dr. Kathy Baldwin is a practicing applied social scientist with a DPhil in social anthropology from the University of Oxford, where she is a postdoctoral associate at the Institute of Social and Cultural Anthropology, ISCA. She is currently a research fellow at Washington, D.C.'s World Resources Institute, an environmental think tank, and is a social impacts consultant to a large UK civil engineering firm. I might add that she has a long association with Malta, where she likes to come and visit. So, Kathy, welcome back to Malta, and we look forward to listening to your paper.
Thank you very much, Paul. Okay, so hello, and thank you for having me. And I like intimate gatherings. They're much more fun, so it's nice just to have a select group to talk to you today. So just to introduce myself, I'm trained as a social anthropologist, an academic social anthropologist, but since finishing my PhD in 2012, I've been working as an applied social scientist. In this work, I'm not a traditional theoretical anthropologist, but I'm a qualitative social researcher, and I work with material from anthropology, sociology, and social psychology, so I have a pretty interdisciplinary pitch there. As Paul mentioned, I'm a postdoctoral affiliate at the University of Oxford, but between 2012 and 2013, I worked as a social science consultant to a large UK civil engineering company that builds all kinds of city infrastructure, so roads, bridges, railways, residential and commercial buildings, and industrial structures, etc. I can't mention the company because there's issues of anonymity in the project I'm going to talk about. So you just take it from me, they're a large one. So most of the kind of developments they work on require impact assessment surveys on different kinds of possible impact. So these range from environmental impact to socioeconomic impact, health impact, visual impact, equalities impact to the UK impact, etc. These surveys are undertaken before a scheme gets finalised and built so that positive impacts can be enhanced and any negative impacts foreseen can be assessed and strategies can be worked out to mitigate or manage them and monitor them as schemes get developed. So personally, I worked on the social and community impact components of environmental health and socioeconomic impact assessments. Out there in the world, there's a thing called a social impact assessment, which are standalone surveys, but they aren't widely practiced or legally recognised in the UK or the EU. And whereas they're big in other countries such as Canada and Australia and in the developing world and so on. In the UK in particular, health impact assessment is the closest thing that we have with legal recognition, which covers some social impacts by examining the potential impacts of the scheme on a thing called the social determinants of health, which I'll be talking about today. So I'm going to talk now about my work on a particular health impact assessment, or an HIA, of a large UK infrastructure project, which I'm going to call Project X for client confidentiality reasons, and in particular, how I advise the leads of the project on incorporating social science concepts and methods into it to broaden the types of social impacts that the survey considered. So the area I work in is very interdisciplinary and it's quite complex. Because if you imagine that external factors in the social environment impact on individuals and in people, they produce mental or cognitive responses. So then you cross over into the territory of social and clinical psychology, and mental responses obviously can lead to kind of, in the worst case scenario, psychological, psychiatric or physiological health outcomes. So then you're moving into kind of biomedicine. So obviously this is a tough area, and there's a kind of continuum from social to psychological to biomedical, and obviously you need interdisciplinary collaboration to cover all of those areas. So what am I going to talk about? Well, here's a kind of outline. I've done the introduction already. I'm going to just give you a quick look at my CV, not self-promotion, but just to show you what kind of things an applied anthropologist gets up to and how that works. I'm just going to give a few pointers on what I think the right approach to applied social science is. Then I'll give a bit of definitional stuff around health impact assessment, what it is, what it's used for, how you do one. Then I'll talk about these things called the social determinants of health, what they are, and in particular the determinants social capital and social cohesion, which was something I focused on in the HIA in question. Then I'll be talking about what we call health pathways for social capital and social cohesion, and then the kind of negative project impacts that can affect those determinants and what the potential health outcomes are. Then in particular, I'll look at the work I did on Project X, the UK case study, what issues arose there, kind of what I did, what could have been done better. And then just by way of conclusion, I'm going to offer some recommendations from an anthropological perspective that could improve the corporate process of an HIA, and things I kind of wish I'd had the opportunity to do had I been fully in charge. So here's my applied social science CV, slightly anonymized because of the nature of working on client confidential projects. So just starting at the bottom, I started off as a broadcast journalist, and then consequently went on to do a lot of work as an NGO press officer, advising international development, environmental and sort of ethnic relations and human rights type of NGOs. So I came from a very practical background before I qualified as an anthropologist. Then at the same time as doing my graduate degrees, I like to collect degrees, so I have 3 graduate degrees, which took a very long time. I started working as an applied anthropologist and did some different assignments that you can see. Training health researchers from the National Health Service in Britain in how to do participant observation for a project on assessing the behaviour of NHS managers with a view to kind of coming up with behaviour change strategies to manage the NHS more efficiently. I worked on a project that evaluated development NGOs' uses of information and communications technology, so the internet, mobile phones and computers, and the way development NGOs use those in different schemes for communities in the developing world to try to generate socioeconomic outcomes for them. And then I did some work with a company in Britain looking at employee perceptions of the company, everything from how people felt about their bosses to what they thought of company recycling policy. So that was a very kind of corporate anthropology assignment. After getting my PhD in 2012, I was lucky enough to get a postdoctoral affiliation to my university, Oxford, but at the same time started working for the engineering company as a social and health impact assessment consultant. And I currently am based in the US in Washington, DC, where I'm a research fellow at the World Resources Institute, which is a large environmental think tank. And there my research is from more of a kind of policy perspective, but I'm working on a project looking at how city planners and architects can incorporate social factors in the hope of creating social benefits for communities in terms of the city infrastructure they plan and design. So that's sort of related to the work I'm going to present today, but it's more focusing on social issues than health ones. I think what I'd say about this kind of CV is that, you know, I started off in sort of practical domain, and as well as having your social science training, I think it's important to be comfortable working in different kinds of professional sectors and be kind of slightly practically minded. And be comfortable to kind of put yourself in the mindset and kind of in line with the professional goals of other sectors. You know, whether it's engineers or the media, you sort of have to be comfortable stepping out of your academic shoes and kind of understanding, you know, what another group of professionals are trying to achieve. So I think in my case, having done, you know, work with NGOs and with media and all sorts of non-academic sectors has just been massively helpful in helping me to kind of build up some empathy for my clients. So I do think you have to, you know, be comfortable at that sort of thing if you want to carry out this sort of work. So moving on, how does one approach influencing non-social scientists with social scientific ideas? This is a difficult one. There's different ways of going about it, but just some kind of principles that I've learnt. So first of all, abandon purist attitudes. That sounds like a rather crude thing to say to academics, but we know that inside academia, anthropological theory is intentionally complex. It's designed to describe the nuances and possibilities of complex scenarios, whereas most industrial or policy or commercial processes and strategies follow more direct paths and are based on a series of decisions and actions that involve some kind of prioritization, making decisions, making choices, saying what's best. In applied social science, complexity sometimes ends up being reduced, but the trade-off is that practical processes can be influenced. So I think if you want to kind of sit theorizing endless possibilities of human behavior and cultural processes without having to, you know, make some concrete decisions, then it's best to stay in academia. Start small. This sounds rather self-deprecating, but even if you have a great theoretical framework from anthropology, it probably won't translate and fit the practical context that you're working in directly. So theories often have to be simplified right down to some very basic key ideas that point to some action that can be taken and justify why the action should be taken. So for example, if you're working with engineers and you have a brilliant theory about all the fluid possibilities in human behavior or cultural processes that may occur when their project impacts on a community, you might find you're reduced to using one simple concept to highlight some key impacts, and that might not be very satisfying from an academic, but in terms of influencing people from your perspective, it's sort of what you have to do. Win their trust by starting with what they know, and when I say they, I mean your non-academic partner or your client. So suppose you're working with engineers or environmentalists, like in my case, you really have to start with their concepts and their terms of reference and see where social science concepts fit in and rename them, you know, to make them clearer if needs be. So for example, if I'm talking to an engineer about them not reducing the social capital in a community by kind of shutting down a footpath if they're trying to build, you know, some new city infrastructure, then instead of talking about social capital, I might just use lots more words and say, you don't want to restrict the access of these people to connecting with their social networks, because obviously that's something they can understand. Infiltrate their framework with your ideas from within their framework. That's kind of a similar point, really. It's best to start with their framework and see how it can be adapted to accommodate, you know, whatever it is you're trying to get across as an anthropologist, whether that's more nuances, more diversity, or kind of trying to replace the cause and effect model with something more processual, seeing things as more of a process as we do. Again, sort of flogging the same horse, really. Be flexible with theory and methods. You often find you're borrowing ideas from all sorts of different sources rather than just being able to use your favourite set of anthropological theories directly when you're trying to address a practical problem. Simplify, simplify, simplify. So simple is best. Whereas academics use complex words as shorthand for complex processes to talk to their peers, outside academia, applied social scientists often need to use simple words, even if more words in a sentence are required, to make a process comprehensible to people without a special training. So that's very important if you want to be influential. And then some influence is better than no influence. Keep your expectations modest, again, which sounds like a silly thing to say, but whereas in academia, People often have lofty goals, you know, when proposing ideal-type theories and talking to their peers. In applied social science, you have to keep your expectations modest and manageable, because in the real world, there are lots of competing frameworks and lots of different ideas, and it's better to have some influence than no influence, I think, and kind of be constantly dissatisfied and critical of the way that other sectors work. You know, if engineers quantify things or reduce things into something which doesn't describe your nuances, if you can put some of the nuances back in, it's better than none. So I hope that makes that clear. So just have a quick sip of iced tea whilst warming up to talk about my actual project. So moving on to the health impact assessment, what is it? Well, this is a very simple definition from the International Association of Impact Assessment, the IAIA. They're a North American professional organization, which is a kind of global umbrella body for impact assessment professionals of all disciplines. And they have some very useful guidance. So they describe a health impact assessment as a form of impact assessment that aims to understand how development induces unintended changes to health determinants and resulting changes to health outcomes. And I'll talk some more about that organisation a bit later on. So what does an HIA investigate or address? Well, it looks at risks associated with health hazards and health improvement opportunities in development. And that means risks associated with health hazards. That means, for example, there's a known connection between prolonged noise exposure and learning difficulties. So the risk is the prolonged noise exposure, and the health hazard might be potential learning difficulties. And health improvement opportunities in development, and that is any opportunity that presents itself to improve the health of the population in the impacted area. Then principally an HIA addresses changes to what we call the determinants of health, and that basically just means all the factors out there that can impact on people's health chances and potential health outcomes. So there's individual determinants, genetic, biological, lifestyle, and circumstantial. And then of most interest to social scientists, there's social and economic health determinants. So those are physical, that's basically the environment around you, the built environment. Community conditions, that's the social environment, and economic and financial conditions. And then there's institutional determinants of health, described here as the capability, capacity, and jurisdiction of public sector institutions and the wider public policy framework supporting the services they provide. So in shorthand, that basically means how well public and health sector institutions provide services and amenities and facilities for maintaining the health, good health status of the population that they serve. And again, this is some wisdom from the IAIA. So if you want to do a health impact assessment, what's involved? Well, it is good news for anthropologists, a step-by-step process. It's very much viewed as a process. There isn't a kind of absolutely set-in-stone format for it, although there are some steps that most health impact assessments pass through. So screening, identifying the scale and type of HIA required, that's the initial step. And that basically means selecting the type of HIA, and the types here I've got listed are non-participatory, consultative but not dialogic, participatory and community-led, and that basically just describes the level and the amount of public involvement in the HIA. So non-participatory, unfortunately, involves no public participation, whereas at the opposite end you've got community-led, and that's when the HIA is commissioned and conducted by the community, often for their own ends, to prove a point to a developer. And I've got some literature listed at the end of the presentation which will allow you, if you wish, and if you wish to contact me through Mr. Paul Clough, to dig into those a bit deeper. Then there's the scoping stage of an HIA, which means setting the terms of reference, the time boundaries, and the spatial parameters of the assessment. At the scoping stage, usually expert HIA practitioners will consult with local health professionals and they'll sort of look at the potential impact area in geographic terms of the HIA and of the proposed project. They'll identify the populations that will be affected, particularly any vulnerable sections. They'll look into potential negative health impacts and benefits, ideally, and think about, you know, some of the strategies that might need to be adopted. So that's kind of the screening stage. Scoping goes into this all a bit further. That's the scoping stage. At scoping stage, as well as an expert consultation, there's usually some policy and data analysis that go on, and you'll have some HIA consultants that will provide what we call a community health profile, using demographic data, looking at the kind of composition of the local population, their living conditions, their economic conditions, their health status, you know, what the sort of prevalent health issues and problems and patterns of disease and infirmity might be in a local area. Just gather up lots of useful information to those ends. And then they usually carry out policy analysis, which involves reviewing any local government policy or any kind of national policy with a local impact that relates to health, the health and well-being and quality of life of the community. And particularly, it's important to kind of get to grips what health management and health enhancement strategies are in place in an area. So when developers start to think about, you know, possible health benefits of a development, anything that they might provide, then they can kind of tie those into existing health and well-being agendas. So that tends to happen at that stage. Then ideally, but not always, unfortunately, there's a step with public engagement or dialogue where the community is consulted and asked what their kind of health fears and aspirations are, you know, what they think may happen when a development is constructed, and, you know, what they'd like to happen in terms of means of addressing any kind of concerns they have. Then moving on, once all that information and public consultation data is collected, the HIA consultants will write a report with recommendations setting out what kind of mitigation and management strategies should be put in place to mitigate and manage any negative health impacts, potential impacts, and address any kind of positive benefits that can be drawn out from the development. So they'll produce a report which will be reviewed by an independent review committee, and then a framework will be established for action steps to be taken by relevant authorities and organisations, and that basically consists of local government, any health care providers and any public authorities with responsibility for any aspect of community health, well-being and quality of life. Then there's a stage where negotiation of resources for health safeguards and mitigation will take place, and that usually focuses on looking at financial implications and who's going to pay for any health safeguards and mitigation. Although it's not always just a question of financial resources, but if there's going to be any kind of community payback, if there are any potential adverse health effects and the developer, as part of being given permission to carry out their development, agrees to, you know, provide any facilities or services or, you know, positive benefits for a community to make up for the negative stuff, then that will be negotiated at that stage. And then once the development is rolled out and being constructed, and then once it's finished and after it's operational, supposing that you're building an airport, for example, there'll be this ongoing process of monitoring and evaluation, making sure that HIA objectives are being met as the scheme's being rolled out. And then a follow-up is obviously looking at how impacts and benefits have been provided or addressed afterwards once it's operational. So that should give you a pretty good overview. In terms of the HIA I worked on in Britain, my role was being employed as an applied social scientist to work on the social determinants of health, and it was on this large UK industrial project, and I can only say the transport sector, I can't identify, unfortunately, any more details about it. So just a few explanatory points here. What are the social determinants of health? They are basically the underlying factors and conditions in life that can influence our health. including the determinant I got most involved with, the social capital and social cohesion, which is most kind of social scientific of them all in a way. HIAs isn't just about identifying possible diseases caused by health impacts. It's about making sure that the wider factors and conditions that can affect people's health aren't doing so in an adverse way. So this model comes from the World Health Organization, and for people on listening on the radio, the determinants we've got listed here are housing, employment or unemployment, education, food production, health and social care, infrastructure comprising transport and connectivity, and water and sanitation, and then issues of crime and safety, and finally social capital and social cohesion. And these determinants come from what we call a social environmental model of health rather than a biomedical model of health, where basically social factors in the kind of wider environments that human beings live their lives in are seen to impact on people. So obviously social factors occur in the physical environment, in the natural environment, and in the social environment that people interact in. So it's really the idea of kind of, you know, taking a broader perspective and situating health in this wider context. So before talking about the actual project, I need to just introduce some key psychological social concepts. And some of these sit on this slightly uncomfortable borderline between sort of sociology and anthropology, so the kind of pure social sciences, and then the psychological sciences. And this can be quite difficult territory for sociologists and anthropologists. So you have to kind of enter into a cross-disciplinary way of thinking here. So I focused my work on the social determinants, social capital and cohesion, where there's a scope to explore the psychosocial impacts of projects on communities, and particularly on the orientations and attachments that residents have to their communities and the built and natural environments around them. So I'm going to introduce some psychological social concepts that were important in terms of the assessment of the impacts of Project X on social capital and social cohesion in affected communities. So again, we're on this kind of continuum between social science, social psychology, and clinical psychology here. So psychological social, or psychosocial for short, is a term really used in the health field. It's an umbrella term which describes the impacts of social factors such as the economy, religion, and family on the individual's mind and behaviour, and then subsequently the psychological responses, things like experiences, perceptions, and feelings, that can develop within individuals and groups in the community as a result of interpersonal relationships and social interactions. Then moving down, there's the concept of attachment and place orientation, which is a kind of umbrella domain for various social science concepts. So these concepts are kind of commonly found and theorized in sociology and anthropology as well. The main ones being sense of community, a sense of being part of a community, identity, having an identity, sense of belonging to people and places, sense of place and awareness of the elements that make a geographic place significant, and place attachment, levels of attachment to different places. And then finally, this idea of the social environment, which according to one American author that I read, she describes it as the immediate physical and social setting and in which an individual lives and in which events happen or develop, including the cultural norms and the social and the people and institutions involved in social interactions. So we can say broadly that individuals cognitively organize a social environment around the attachments and the orientations that they have within that environment. So moving on, just some more information about the health impact assessment. So the social determinants that were investigated in Project X, the particular project I worked on, were housing, employment and economy, health and social care, transport and connectivity, crime and safety, and social capital and social cohesion. And that topic is most closely connected to psychosocial orientations and attachments to people and places. And myself and another HIA consultant who worked on the project were given these determinants by the Environmental and Engineering Leads. So these weren't the factors that we chose to look at ourselves. The impacts of the scheme were evaluated against these social determinants, and when we were doing some initial work at the scoping stage, we looked at local demographic data, and we evaluated local policy goals relating to these determinants to see hypothetically how the scheme might change them. So going specifically into this determinant, social capital and social cohesion, both of which can act as determinants, what is social capital? Well, there's lots of different definitions of it, and depending on who you like, the one I use is Putnam 1993, who describes it as the features of social organisation that facilitate coordination and cooperation for mutual benefit in communities at local level. If we look more closely at these features of social organisation, then we can see that they're broken into structural components and psychological components. Structural components, you know, being concepts relating to the way we structure our social life and social interactions, being things like social network, civic participation, reciprocity between people, cooperation between community members. And if we look at what the psychological dimension of all of this is, it's things like place attachment, identity, trust between community members, behavioural norms. And then doing the same thing for social cohesion. It's a related concept, and I go along with Forrest and Kern's 2001 definition, and they describe it as individuals and groups getting by and getting on at the mundane level of everyday life. And something I've observed is that it describes the state of relationships in a community and the perception of social cohesion being present or the lack of it in a community is a psychosocial factor. So again, we can identify structural components of social cohesion and those being the strong relationships and networks in the community. And the psychological dimension is really how people perceive it, if they think it's present, if they identify themselves as being part of a cohesive community. High levels of social capital can produce cohesive communities with common understandings between residents. So in most health impact assessments, the view is taken that infrastructure projects shouldn't have a negative impact on the levels of social capital or make communities less cohesive. In the UK, some HIAs have looked at project impacts on the structural but not the psychosocial side of social capital and social cohesion, and I argue that this fails to produce a complete understanding of potential changes within a community. So what needs to happen? The structural and the psychological impacts of projects must both be explored as part of the health impact assessment process. As social scientists, we know that structure and social perception in the way that people experience communities impact on each other in unpredictable ways. Practically speaking, developers often understand the structure of a community not in terms of its networks, but in terms of the social infrastructure, the kind of community facilities and amenities that exist in an area with a socio-residential community. They often conflate this idea of structure with infrastructure. And as anthropologists and social scientists, we know that, even in, say, a village with a fantastic community centre or some sort of, wonderful facilities where people can kind of come together and hypothetically might experience a sense of community, they may not use them. That might not happen. Whereas you might find kind of a residential area where, there isn't so much that's sort of happening visibly at the level of community formation in public areas, but you might find people interacting, in the private space on their doorsteps or kind of talking to their neighbours across the fence in the back garden, and a sense of community might, result from those informal interactions rather than, there being a fantastic place where people can meet and proclaim themselves as a community. So obviously that's something that developers need to understand properly. So we can say really that sometimes a quality social environment can exist in spite of poor social infrastructure, and it's very localised and kind of context specific what's actually happening here. So we can't say that there's a cause and effect relationship between structure and psychosocial aspects. So it's really important to look at both dimensions. So this, moving on to the health side of things, this slide shows some different subcomponents of social capital and social cohesion as health determinants. It shows the impacts on people when levels of both are good in a community, and then it outlines some of the positive health impacts that can result. And sorry for the radio people, this is regarding relying on a visual here. But if we look at the third row down, highlighted in black, we can see the health determinant community attachment under the social capital topic. This is a psychosocial determinant that occurs when people have lived in a place for a long time and they have strong networks. It can result in a sense of belonging, identity, etc., and other kinds of attachments. And having high levels of community attachment can lead to positive emotional and mental health. It also contributes positively to community resilience, a quality of communities where they have the ability to cope with and withstand difficulties. Say in the event of natural disaster. So there's obviously a lot of information there, but that's just to give you an example. Then this is kind of looking at the reverse. This slide shows some potential project impacts on social capital and social cohesion subcomponents and possible subsequent negative health outcomes. So if we look at row 3, highlighted in black, we can see that the potential erosion of landscapes and buildings that are important to a community who feels strongly attached to them can change the way that people relate to an area, perhaps lowering their attachment to it. And this in turn can create negative feelings and, in the worst case, some sort of stress, which leaves people more vulnerable to health problems and sort of mental health problems in particular. So crudely going into health impacts themselves and potential health conditions that can develop in the worst case scenario, when there is the threat or the real possibility of negative changes in the social environment where people feel ordinarily securely orientated, strongly attached, and experience many positive feelings, they can experience many negative feelings and become vulnerable to psychological and psychiatric illness. And chronic disease, which is often mediated by stress. And obviously these place a greater burden on healthcare services. So just for anybody listening on the radio, we've got under the kind of psychological and psychiatric illness category, anxiety, stress, depression, and suicides. And in the chronic disease category, some examples are high blood pressure, stroke, heart disease, and any condition resulting from depression of the immune system, such as diabetes, arthritis, cancer, and obesity. So obviously not good news there. So moving on to the UK and the kind of case study part of all this information, what's happening in the UK at the moment? We know from social science community studies around the UK that notions of social residential community, so having a kind of strong sense of community in the place where you live, and another thing, place-linked social identities, such as, you know, being happy to call yourself a Londoner or a Glaswegian or, you know, a Gozoan or a kind of person from Big Oak Village. I don't know what Valletta residents call themselves, but I'm sure there's a local equivalent. So those are all place-linked identities. But in the context of the UK, they're culturally important, and there's a lot of evidence from ethnography and from social science kind of studies since before, going back to before the 60s, that have shown that. The UK public can be particularly resistant to developmental changes because the concept of the local is very important in the UK national psyche. It wasn't until the 1990s that it became politically legitimate kind of among left-wing people to say that they were proud to be British. Before, there was a kind of negative connotation of nationalism with being right-wing and racism and fascism and things like that. It changed in the 90s, but you know, in place of kind of a strong nationalism, localism has always kind of been the dominant thing, and people, you know, have quite legitimately been very patriotic about a kind of local sense of pride in all sorts of different urban and rural communities in Britain, and there's plenty of social science evidence of that as well. As I've said before, social impact assessments aren't legally mandatory, in Britain from the point of view of examining the community impacts of development. So the social determinants of health within UK HIAs are the key legally recognised context for examining social and psychosocial project impacts on people. The Merseyside guidelines is a very useful set of guidelines that have come out of the impact unit that works on health impact assessment at Liverpool University. And fortunately, they recognise the social environment as a key area influencing health. So that's very useful in terms of pushing this agenda in Britain. Several years ago, a team of London think tank people, key UK HIA experts and others, released a new tool called the Mental Wellbeing Impact Assessment Kit in 2011. And although that's not legally mandatory yet, it's kind of, you know, being very beneficial at stressing the links between development and mental health, and recognising the kind of need to expand coverage of mental health issues and development. There is a kind of critical camp that have questioned whether or not HIA, you know, as the kind of dominant health assessment, should just do better at looking at mental health issues. Obviously, kind of subjective well-being is a lot harder to measure than kind of the outcomes of biomedical conditions. So there are people arguing that HIA should just expand their coverage of mental health, but obviously having a special assessment tool is helpful in that case. I know from conversations with key UK HIA practitioners that there's a growing appetite for more coverage of orientation and attachment factors, and kind of bringing in this social science influence and kind of, you know, the way that anthropologists and sociologists work with these concepts and kind of linking them better to health outcomes. But obviously, you know, it's kind of a complex territory, and there aren't that many people that can kind of do sociology and clinical psychology at the same time, so it's kind of a question of where the expertise is coming from. What are the key barriers, and why hasn't this happened more widely? Well, many UK HIAs are done very quickly within a rapid time, particularly as stipulated by private sector developers, and that can be really a barrier to using qualitative methods like focus groups, semi-structured interviews, clinical interviews, scenario building workshops, and locally devised questionnaire surveys for sort of getting at those attachments and place orientations. They are done in a few HIAs, but they tend to be the kind of very well-resourced, university-led, local HIAs rather than kind of grand national schemes and things like that. Many developers arguably wish to focus on the proposal and not get drawn into wider community issues, but coming from a sort of ethical, anthropological perspective, you know, it could be argued that if they want to meet sustainable development goals, they need to consider the long-term sustainability of the social environment in the area where they're proposing to build a development. As I've hinted, there aren't always sociologists or anthropologists or psychologists available in an HIA team. Quite often people are scientific and don't have any kind of social science training, so that's an inhibitor. And although there's growing interest, there's kind of a lack of published HIAs showing actually what progress is being made and how many of the assessments coming out, you know, are bringing in the social science dimension more strongly. Because HIAs are often, you know, commissioned by developers that have a lot of confidentiality contracts and clauses about what aspects of their plans they can make public. That's a kind of inhibitor to kind of publicly publishing more of these assessments, more of the results of them. So there could be, you know, a lot more good work going on that we're not aware of, kind of in the HIA practitioner discussion circles. But, you know, certainly it's a growing interest area. And there's kind of keenness for more openness about what's happening. So finally, talking directly about Project X, it was a large infrastructure project affecting many communities over a sizable geography. It involved government agencies and private sector engineering companies. Personally, I was involved in devising indicators and methodology compiling the demographic community health profile at the scoping stage, and reviewing government sector policies and strategies with a bearing on the determinants of health. Unfortunately, because of these confidentiality clauses, I can't tell you exactly what we did or what the final outcomes were, but I can say that our significant achievement was persuading the client, as it were, the kind of entity among these authorities that commissioned the HIA, to integrate orientation and attachment considerations into the HIA under the social capital and social cohesion topic. And those orientation and attachment factors surfaced as key indicators in the assessment. Their importance in health pathways was shown, and their importance as entities being impacted by project changes were highlighted, so that was very useful. I got sort of deeply involved in the social capital and social cohesion aspect because I was a social scientist in the team. When I began to work on the HIA, I was initially presented with two indicators that came from the environmental and engineering leads to measure the impact of the scheme on social capital and social cohesion. And these were counting the number of community centres and then counting the number of cultural and faith venues before and after the scheme was built. And obviously, as a social scientist, I kind of threw up my arms in the air and had a kind of shock-horror reaction because we know very well that, you know, the availability of physical venues for kind of cultivating community doesn't mean that people in the experiential or the psychological sense will feel a sense of community or belonging or identity in a place. So social advancement isn't achieved through physical means alone. So I challenged that, and luckily enough was given permission to kind of intervene. So after I'd done my bit, things looked a little different, and I'm just going to show you three charts that sort of show some of the potential impact areas that were identified, what we call the health pathway, so the kind of pathway between an impact and the health outcome that might result in an individual, and then the potential health impact, potential health effects, so what the health conditions that might occur as a result of an impact in a person, you know, what health outcomes that person might experience. So I'm going to show you three charts that show the social capital health pathways that we mapped out to look at project impacts on health before and during construction and then during the operation of the development. So this chart here tackles pre-construction impacts. If we think about housing blight or kind of urban decay, you know, when buildings in a city fall into a state of disrepair, and then we think about local people being able to move out or not move out. People that move out, you know, may result in networks, social networks being broken up. People who can't move out may feel resentful. If some people move out and new people move in, you know, this might result in a change in local social relationships, possibly for the worse. People who can't afford to move may start to feel negatively about where they live, you know, their community. It might change their sense of place. They might lose a sense of belonging. They might not like it there anymore. And all of these have potential impacts in the kind of negative mental stress domain. So if we move on, and then we look at this chart, which shows health pathways during construction. If we look at the first row and we think about the presence of construction workers in the community, so for some of these very large kind of developments that occur over a big geographical scale. Obviously, scales in England are bigger than scales in Malta, so it could be, you know, several hundred area kind of with an impact area of several hundred miles. If you imagine a large construction workforce moving into, say, your village, construction workers might be present there using local facilities. This might change the social dynamic in kind of public places. It might cause feelings of worry about safety locally among the kind of existing population. People might worry about the integration of these new workers. And this might result in social tensions affecting local perceptions of social cohesion. And it's affecting things like people's place attachment and the way they identify with where they live. Again, linking to potential negative mental health impacts and stresses and so on. And then finally, this final table shows what can happen during the operation of the development. It shows potential health pathways after construction. And if we look at the first row, the second column, and we think about the change of the impact of changes to the local environment, this can be anything from the way it looks, the way people are able to access it and experience it, or its availability. So supposing a local wilderness is no longer available, then this can result in a loss of the identity of a place, and it can lower people's levels of place attachment, again, kind of impacting them in the domain of negative feelings and potential mental stress, and so on. I have to add a slight disclaimer, and health impact assessments tend to focus more on the negative stuff, because obviously it's a survey that's intended to draw out anything adverse that may happen and kind of protect people in advance of that, although there should ideally be an equal focus on benefits and so on. But there's always trade-offs. So, sort of coming towards the end, what were the pros and cons of the survey that I was involved in? Well, personally, I felt there were a lot of limitations around the methodology that we were able to use and given permission to use. Although the client was sympathetic to the idea of face-to-face research with the community, the regulator forbid it, so consultants were left to guess factors and impacts based on pre-existing data and previous experience of health impact assessments, and then expert stakeholder consultations were carried out with public health officials. So that wasn't very satisfactory from my point of view. Other teams working on different impact areas, there was a team that was working on the impact of changes to the community's physical access with the construction of this particular development. For example, roads and footpaths being closed whilst the development was being constructed. These teams were given permission to consult the public directly, and through this they reported a lot of kind of general anxiety and general unhappiness with it that was being expressed back to us HIA people, but we weren't given permission to engage the community ourselves, so that was problematic for me as an anthropologist. You know, one thing I recommended to the project developers was not just, if they weren't able to consult the public directly for various reasons, one thing they could have done, and which I hope they did, was to go and talk to the community relations officers on local councils, because those people in Britain have a wealth of knowledge about local social dynamics and kind of local attachments and the way that the sort of constituent elements of a population perceive their local area. So that kind of in place of being able to do a proper community consultation would have been something better than nothing. So I very much hope that occurred. Obviously, guesswork is not good enough, and the fact that community consultation didn't occur can be recognised as poor practice according to some of the best practice standards and guidelines issued by some prominent impact association organisations. I've already mentioned the International Association of Impact Assessment, and then the Merseyside guidelines on HIA from Britain as well advocate community consultation. It was a national level scheme affecting many communities, and the irony is that many of the local, very kind of micro local development projects that do very detailed community level HIAs do fantastic community consultation. So from my point of view, it was very unfortunate that this national project didn't address the issue. And finally, if anthropologists are in charge and they have their way, and they are able to infiltrate the HIA and kind of, set the terms and conditions, what could an anthropologist offer to improve the corporate process? The good thing was that myself and my colleague were able to work on the psychosocial orientation and attachment factors and bring them to the developer's attention as kind of key variables subject to change, and also to show their place in health impact pathways and show how project effects might change them. So that was great. My company, I have to, you know, give them a thumbs up with the fact that they let a social scientist into the HIA team, and they were very positive about that. So I think in terms of recommendations, HIAs should definitely include a social scientist, because particularly with the social determinants of health, it's a very kind of cross-border territory between social issues and medical issues. So it's great if there's a social person in the team. I think it's absolutely vital to take a kind of initial assessment of some kind, you know, of the kinds of attachments and orientations that people have to the place where they live and the other people living there. You know, and this should be done by asking residents to articulate through questioning what locally significant factors are and how they are conceptualised. For example, what comprises in a sense of place? You can't know in advance what types of orientations and attachments people have. Sense of place may be relevant in one area and not in another, whereas, you know, attachment to the community, so the people living there, might be the key thing in another place. I think residents should be asked how current notions might change with project impacts and how this might make them feel. Obviously, this gives some clues as to mental impact. To this end, I think it's wise to involve the community at scoping stage, you know, right at the beginning, before there's any formal consultation. I think some community members should be included in, you know, initial discussions about what project impacts might be and what might be significant from the community's point of view. When you get to the actual consultation stage, I think it's important that it should be approached from a self-revealing angle rather than a preemptive angle, e.g. asking the community to set the agenda and reveal what's significant to them rather than preempting what that might be. I think mixed methods is important. You need qualitative methods to look at kind of subjective perceptions in depth, whereas quantitative data is important for getting context of scale. Obviously, you know, creating original questionnaire surveys with open-ended questions is a good tool. We know that national surveys are good for comparison across geographies, but kind of specifically locally created surveys are good for HIAs because they outline the public's priorities. And I think also participatory techniques can be used to involve the public in working out management and mitigation strategies that they can be involved in and can benefit from. So final point, really. Overall, including these psychosocial factors in the areas of attachment and orientation in communities not only increases the scope of health considerations in an HIA and opens up the mental health dimension more thoroughly, but it also can contribute to the long-term sustainability of the social environment. So thank you. Just quickly, this isn't really going to be much benefit to people listening on the radio, but there are some very useful websites you can consult for more information on impact assessment more generally. One is the website of the International Association of Impact Assessment, and that is www.iaia.org, or if you just Google IAIA, that will produce it. On that same website, there's some very useful guidance and kind of best practice principles for health impact assessment. So you can search for that through that website, or again, just Google. I've got some useful references here. Probably the best thing is if anybody's interested to email Dr. Clow, and maybe he can forward those on. There's a reference that looks specifically at different forms of HIA by Harris, Roxas and Harris, and their article from 2011 is called Differing Forms, Differing Purposes, A Typology of Health Impact Assessment. So that's an article that's worth looking at. That's the end. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Cathy. It's a very complete picture. Are there any questions which people would like to ask?
My comment is that with the local background, with the local situation in mind, I think this would be of interest for local councils, and also there is a possibility of even involving some educational process that these ideas, as anthropological ideas, can be filtered through the local councils and even private investors, private developers. And at the moment, I think we are still on the basis of an environment impact assessment rather than the health impact assessment. But as you say, with the psychosocial effects of projects and it's important that we develop. Malta has only a 20-year history of local council. Before that, there weren't even local councils to start with. So these ideas, I think, these concepts must be encouraged. This is my take.
Just a question of information before we go on. In Malta, aren't SIAs now legally required, social impact assessment? I'm just wondering what the situation is here. I think SIAs are required now because it's a growing field. Social impact assessment is a growing field in Malta, but I'm not quite sure of the legal...
I'm not sure whether social impact assessments are mandatory. If we take, for example, the recent development on the power station, there's a lot of controversy, political controversy, but having objective criteria whereby the discussion can take place in the first place is important. Now, unfortunately, in Malta, these objective criteria are not so clear-cut in the minds of the people. And we tend to engage in political discussion. But as you know, probably, in Malta also, we are moving out of this binary polarization into more objective examination of they will have effects on the population as a whole, not just on the individual. We tend to go to the doctor, tell him, look, we have this, and that, and then it's a personalized analysis. But I think we should move out of such binary or polarized situations and have more objective, as Paul said, if there is mandatory SIS, social impact assessment.
So partly in answer to Professor Klaus's question and continuing on the points which Mario is making, I think the biggest blind spot in current practice in Malta, one which has been charted out very clearly by Cathy in emerging practice in Britain, is this direct link between attachment to place and all those social factors and health impact. And towards the end, you were speaking about preemptive consultations and a preemptive approach to impact assessment, as opposed to one which truly engages with issues. And there's a great deal of that going on in which, even in the design of an impact assessment, it's already a loaded process in which you parcel out issues and hence reduce their significance and their weight in the final decision. So if you isolate these social factors, such as attachment to place, and almost marginalize them as almost a fringe concern which should be secondary to economic financial considerations, even if you're not explicitly saying that, there's a great danger in which you don't even find the discourse to articulate the direct impact on actual physical health, which the neglect of these factors will lead to. And there is a great absence, I think, of a tradition of awareness and even ability to articulate how a price is being paid here in the face of short-term financial gain. And my question about this is, because you've charted out how this is a fairly recent development, it's emerging practice, what were the motors that drove this recognition of the nexus between these social factors and health impact? Because it is a very powerful argument, which does make people sit up and pay more attention to those consequences once you chart it out in terms of disease, both mental and physical. And there must have been plenty of vested interests to resist that nexus being made. How did it come about? What were the motors that drove it, if that's a fair question to ask?
Sure. I mean, this is in particular my expertise, because I've come, you know, into this one particular assessment from a different background. And I have done some reading around kind of the history of HIA, but I know the idea of the social determinants of health comes from the World Health Organization, and from international development in particular. And I couldn't give you exact dates, but I think probably within the last decade, the social model of health has kind of become more dominant in the UK than the biomedical model of health, whereas I know that in North America, in the US in particular, a lot of the HIA is done there. Still, you know, more traditionally rest on this biomedical model of health. So I suppose from the international development world, you know, where there's a drive to kind of go beyond economic development, and the sort of social, the linkage between health and broader social welfare, that's, as far as I know, that's the kind of, like the WHO's drive to sort of opening up kind of the range of things that they work with, and particularly in the UK HIA world. I know the Merseyside guidelines, I think, came out in 2008, and that was kind of, I think it was 2008, we might have to check that out, but it was within kind of 5 years of that, and I know that document was a kind of major enshrining, you know, its institutionalization of this social model, you know, being the one to focus on. Although objectively around the UK, it's sort of a matter of preference, and there's different camps. But certainly the social model is particularly popular kind of premise for doing an HIA. And the idea of social capital and social cohesion being health issues, as well as social science issues, that I think is about 10 years old in UK HIA. And I certainly emailed the... There's a fantastic resource called HIA.net, which is a global mailing list for HIA practitioners. It's very active. There's a lot of peer support because the HIA practitioner community in Britain and abroad is so small. I mean, you know, I wouldn't like to give you numbers, probably talking hundreds of people rather than thousands. And I, when I saw this topic within the HIA and I was kind of presented with the social determinants that we were supposed to look at in this project, then I emailed this list to ask when that topic first appeared, you know, on an HIA checklist, and people sort of said, oh, about 10 years ago, you know, around, I think 2000 was sort of the year that social capital became a public policy concern at large in Britain and the government started to invest money in it. Yeah, so I suppose, you know, in the sort of crossover territory between social and health issues, this stuff probably creeping in from the late 90s.
Can I just ask you, again, these are just some factual questions. Is HIA legally mandatory? If so, when was it installed?
It's not. It's kind of positively outlined in several of the national laws in Britain, and there is one national law which is applicable at local level in the UK, which requires that local councils, before giving absolute permission to any local development, need to show through some form that they've considered the health impact of the development on the local population's health. And I don't have the exact dates and the exact documents, but I have them, you know, to mind, but I do have them somewhere on my computer and in my reading list, so I could look those up if you want.
Because I was intrigued by this factor of attachment to place. I mean, it did stand out, I think, very strongly.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering, is that something which has gradually been concocted by sociologists, anthropologists, and other HIA practitioners so that it's become a kind of quote-unquote industry standard that they apply when they do HIA if they're required by the law to do it? Is that how it's... Is there a lot of latitude that's allowed under the law such that this is what emerges?
I mean, as far as I know, with kind of the main law in Britain, and again, I'm afraid I can't give you dates and name the law directly, but it's in my notes somewhere, is that HIA is the preferred tool for local councils wishing to meet this planning requirement by showing they've considered the impact of any development on the local population's health. And the kind of appearance of this, you know, concern with attachments and orientations and place attachments and belonging and things like that, it's a kind of ad hoc thing, partially because, within each assessment, the kind of leaders of the assessment select the determinants they think are relevant themselves, and this may or may not include something around community cohesion, social network, social capital. That's the way they usually frame the sort of, you know, broader topic area that sort of people's place attachments and local identifications and stuff fall under. And then it just in a kind of ad hoc way, it depends on the skills of the team, and it depends on, you know, what the at the scoping and screening stage, what sort of the key issues that are forecast as being, based on the local population, that's how, these things get considered or not. So there is no kind of local law, and within the local law, there is no stipulation of exactly what topics should be considered, or exactly how the HIA should be carried out and who should carry it out. So I think it's a kind of ad hoc local thing, really, if that makes sense.
At what point does it become a public document?
Sometimes it never does. It depends on the particular scheme, because some schemes, are an agreement between a local government and a private developer, and sometimes it might be a publicly funded project. So if it's publicly funded with government money, as in the case of some of the major transport projects, because obviously you're providing, public right of way, then those assessments tend to be published and made available in the public domain. But sometimes when it's, a collaboration between a private developer who might be kind of offering enormous financial and resource benefits to a local council, the developer might be within their rights to not publish it. Or maybe just produce an executive summary. So there is no kind of hard and fast rule, I think. But I have to stress that, I'm not I don't have a long history of expertise in HIA. It's something I've come into as an outsider and as a social scientist. So I know the right resources to kind of point you to on some of the factual specifics about the legal status and stuff.
I would like to put another question, if possible.
Yeah.
Taking, for example, a practical example, here we have a controversy at the moment, power station, oil tank, oil being replaced by gas and so on, gas power station and so on, a big controversy. Now, what are the time frames? I mean, if an HIA had to be undertaken, it's very urgent, hasn't been done for 10 years, I mean, it's been pending for 10 years, this project, now it's on, must be done very quickly. Mm-hmm. What kind of time frame would you envisage if such an HIA had to be prepared?
For a power station?
For a power station to be commissioned.
I mean, they really take months, sometimes they can take years. It depends completely on the resources, the kind of the number of personnel available to carry it out, the intensity of, public and government pressure.
What I meant is that the political conditions necessitate that decisions be taken
quickly
yesterday,
okay,
or the day before.
Yeah.
Now, if it comes to that situation, how can the science help at all? Now we want to resolve this problem, and we want to move out of this problem. But we might be creating an HIA problem instead. So how can this be resolved? There's no time. There's no time available at all. It's negative time. It should have been done 10 years ago.
Sure.
Now, how can such a problem be tackled at all from the HIA angle?
Sure. I mean, HIAs ideally should be carried out before a development gets built in the first place, because their purpose is predictive impacts that can be addressed and kind of factored into a development plan. But they do sometimes occur, industrial sites or power plants and things like that, when a license is up for renewal, when the permit to operate is up for renewal, or on something that's being decommissioned or something, you know, that, as you say, has been deemed problematic, and, you know, problems need to address if the site and the industrial operation is to kind of continue in the future. HIAs on that scale can't really be done quickly. I mean, certainly you can get in an HIA team to do an assessment that looks at the kind of current state, and you know, look at the sort of available data on the history of the problematic impacts, and make recommendations based on, you know, ideally what should happen to minimise the existing problems. But again, it depends completely on the scale of the operation, you know, the kind of political allowance, the kind of for more time to be given.
It's a very big scale, isn't it?
Yeah.
It affects two villages at least.
From oil to gas, yes. To the entire...
At the moment,
100,000 people, yeah, 9 miles.
Yeah, yeah. Million. I mean, something of that scale can't really
but
be done.
The problem is that the main problem is that it was envisaged that Malta would change the fuel,
yeah,
from oil to gas, but it was dependent on having a pipeline.
Sure.
Now, this pipeline, to comes into effect, it will take another number of years.
Yeah.
And this present government, yeah, elected last year,
yeah,
will not wait,
yeah,
these years,
yeah,
because this will means that the consumers will have to pay present rates.
So they want to,
and it's a commitment, it's a electoral commitment that it must reduce the rates,
yeah,
within 12 months.
Yeah.
So, and these are coming effect from the 1st of April,
yeah,
the reduction in this is a electoral commitment. So the power station must change from heavy fuel oil, mm-hmm, to gas.
Yeah.
In a very, but it's creating the discussion going,
yeah,
on now is,
yeah,
that there might be an HIA problem.
Yeah. I mean, they can be because there is such a thing as a rapid HIA, and they're fairly common, but they're usually done on, you know, a single institution or a kind of very small-scale project, so then it's quite easy to get. You don't need as much data, you don't need as many people looking at things. The impact area is a lot smaller, so time-wise that's more manageable. But if you want to, say, do a rapid HIA of a very big thing, then you're going to be, you know, losing depth of data. You might just get very kind of superficial information. It depends, because HIA is a research process and it involves, you know, looking at existing data on...
Limiting the problem to one specific issue, because now this problem has been reduced to one specific issue.
Yeah.
Whether the gas storage,
yeah,
should take place,
yeah,
inside the harbour or,
yeah,
outside.
Yeah.
This is how it's been reduced by,
yeah,
the environment authority.
Yeah.
This is reduced now to one specific issue.
Well, most HIAs and EIAs look at alternatives. So if there's you know, if a particular kind of industrial installation is proposed, they'll look at it, but they'll also look at, you know, is there anything better that can be done and should it be done at all? So that type of HIA can quite easily be applied to something where two different options are being considered, but you know, it would almost be like, in that case, it's not the consideration of an alternative to a single scheme, but you're talking about almost two schemes. And if there's a very short time frame available, you know, depending on the budget depending on the budget of personnel that the government puts up to fund the HIA, and depending on, you know, the availability of existing data that sort of identifies all the, you know, the factual information that's needed to consider the impact from a kind of energy point of view, from a health point of view, from a population point of view, it might be possible. But you know, sometimes an initial time frame from an HIA is set, but then as you know, the assessment gets carried out, kind of complicating factors get discovered, which means that it takes a lot longer because kind of new information needs to be gathered, and sometimes an original survey is the only option in that case. So. Yeah, you can do, it depends on the, another thing is, you know, HIAs are of varying standards, and you can certainly kind of rush at the task and use a limited selection of data, but then that kind of limits the impacts and the kind of, you know, the amount of stuff that you're able to say and the type of recommendations you can give. So, you know, the best case and the kind of, you know, the ideal standard is to have as much data, to have as much time and to have as many people as possible.
I think an underlying problem in the Maltese context, and it's quite a chronic, long-standing problem, by no means specific to this project, but it's symptomatic, is the extent to which one is truly committed to letting decisions be informed by the whole impact assessment process,
yeah.
Because it can be subverted in all sorts of ways.
Yeah.
You can have massive documents which gloss over the fundamental issues and produce lengthy texts, mm-hmm. which you have to wade through to make sense.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have situations where impact assessments are ultimately influenced and shaped by development interests, so there could be an anthropology dissertation in this, looking at how we manage to go through the motions,
yeah.
and yet subvert the mechanism.
I mean, one big critique in the world of impact assessment practitioners is sometimes HIAs are commissioned by the developer, so then the consultants have no option, you know, but to kind of tell the developer what they want to hear. And even if, you know, somebody like me gives a critical voice in an HIA, they can choose to ignore your advice, and it can become, you know, something of a frustrating box-ticking exercise where they say, oh, we've got Dr. So-and-so to come along and, you know, she reviewed the data, these are the recommendations, we haven't actually had to show anyone the report. So, you know, we've done our job, we've done the impact assessment. It depends on the kind of the integrity and the, you know, the tactics of the people commissioning it, the people that read it, how they respond to the recommendations. It's very variable.
Presumably there would be various HIAs out there in one single planning event for one particular project. You will have the HIA commissioned by the company,
yeah.
who has the contract or is,
yeah.
seeking the contract.
Yeah.
You'll have another HIA commissioned by the local council,
yeah.
a third by the ministry, etc. I mean, I can see there might be four or five HIAs being commissioned in an important project.
Yeah,
And they would all be using their arguments from the HIA in order to win their point.
Sure. I mean, it depends on, again, it depends on the parties involved, because, for example, the World Bank and the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, some of these development banks, as part of a condition of giving a loan to a development project, they themselves commission the HIA and use their own consultants. So hypothetically, in that scenario, you know, it's being produced objectively by outsiders, I wouldn't say a neutral organisation, but a managerial organisation. You know, are those HIAs to be trusted more than an HIA commissioned by a private developer themselves? Probably.
Well, this is where I think your experience is very interesting, because
yeah.
surely the big question here is that, on the one hand, the Western world is moving into a much more regulatory environment.
Yeah.
All the time I'm hearing this,
yeah.
from commentators in Malta,
yeah.
and in Britain,
yeah.
in various contexts,
mm-hmm.
that we have more regulations which we now must install,
mm-hmm.
which stymie our capacity for action.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, this mm-hmm. same Western world is supposedly moving into a more highly competitive neoliberal environment where competition is considered to be the norm, and where the maximization of profit is considered to be the best selector of the rational decision. So under these circumstances, clearly there's plenty of room for manipulation,
yeah.
plenty of room for what we would call, or used to call, corruption.
Yeah.
You see, I mean,
yeah.
and I've heard that in a local case.
Yeah.
It was involving, I think, Mario, it was involving the background to the decision taken by the last government to go in for the oil-based project. And I have to be careful what I say, an anthropology graduate was very interested in his MSc in another country, in environmental science, and then using both anthropological and, you know, environmental science tools, he went to work here in Malta, in a very successful environmental consultancy. He became their lead man. Unfortunately, he's not on the island, that's why I couldn't invite him. He's got a very interesting job
yeah.
in Brussels at the moment.
All right.
The point is that
he said the pressures were enormous.
Mm.
And the stakeholders were so powerful,
mm.
both the private company and the government stakeholders mm. were such powerful interests,
mm.
that the in SIA considerations mm. tended to get submerged.
Mm.
Because their main concern was how to see off their opposition.
Mm.
Because the opposition, if I remember correctly, was coming from Marsish Lok Council. And how the question was how to contain that opposition,
mm.
contain the publicity,
mm.
get the right decision,
mm.
you see. So this is the environment
mm.
in which these decisions are being taken, and I suspect it's far from just being the case in Malta.
Absolutely.
I suspect it would be the case in Britain,
yeah.
where the competitive ethos has been particularly instilled
mm.
over the last 20 years.
Mm. I mean, I was lucky. This HIA was a government-funded project, so there was more, you know, there was, I can say, a degree of integrity in it. I did some work for my American employer at the moment on HIA in Thailand and Indonesia last autumn, and I'm just trying to remember the precise scenario, but in Indonesia, HIAs are carried out by only private consultancies that wish to be paid by the government, and the government gives out permits to operate to all the private industrial companies. So basically, you know, the government commissions an HIA for a project that it wishes, you know, to give permission to, so that the project, you know, the industrial installation creates economic development for the country. So in that scenario, the community and the academic sector and the NGO sector are extremely sceptical about most HIAs, because they're not being carried out by independent consultants and by a kind of an objective party in the mix of sectors. So although Thailand has kind of the best institutional and legal framework on HIA in Asia, it's expansive and impressive, then, you know, amongst the community sector, there's absolutely no trust in the HIA process.
My final comment is that there will never be the perfect conditions
no.
for such a nature health impact assessment to be done. I mean, there is always going to be problems. Mm-hmm. In our case, in the case we talked about, it was special because of the isolation of Malta, the smallness of the country, having only one power station. Oh. There were a number of problems which accumulated over the years mm-hmm. and brought to a standstill, to a situation of a standstill, mm-hmm. where then it had to be a right about turn, dramatic. For Malta, was a dramatic election result with all the consequences. So I don't envisage to have such problems occurring so frequently. But in our case, it's a dramatic problem and it took proportions, very large proportions. But I think, even at this very late hour, I think there can be something done to minimize to mitigate the fears that people in Marsash Lok might be suffering, that their property values are declining, that their health is being sacrificed,
yeah.
and so on.
I think the answer is probably a community-led HIA, because I know in Thailand, and that's something you know, academics that sort of do research on the HIA process are kind of collaborating with communities to do. So the community sets the terms of reference, and they determine the issues to be looked at, and they carry out the consultation themselves. So there's kind of an atmosphere of trust, and they've got kind of the support of academic analysts to help them process the data and obtain it. And I think that's something, you know, that the government in Thailand is very positive about. They regard HIA as a, I think they define it as a kind of community learning process. You know, you might argue that from a kind of neoliberal perspective, that's just, you know, passing the responsibility of the public sector over to the public themselves, putting them in charge of their own health and well-being. But given the shape of kind of Thailand's HIA structure, last time I read about it, I think it's probably a very valuable tool, because at least the community then have the evidence to argue from.
My question relates to the health profiling of the community.
Sure.
You were in your exercise, you were identifying the social capital and social coherence, cohesiveness determinants, which affect or which potentially can affect health. Can it work the other way around? That is, can one start from the health profiling of a community and work back to social capital issues or to social cohesion issues, which have resulted in that kind of health profiling of the community? I know that there
what
are.
What do you mean?
Would the health profile of a community mm-hmm. be sufficient to provide you with insights into the, for example, you mentioned attachment to place, links with other people in the community? Because what comes to mind is a number of communities in Malta which we very much identify with depressed areas or with less privileged areas that have a very strong commitment to the place and a very strong community sense and very strong dynamics within that community, mm-hmm. but still they suffer from a number of social issues with high crime rates, mm-hmm. with low employment figure. With difficulty to access social resources such as education and other aspects. So there can be very strong social binding aspects to a community.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure whether those translate into negative health profiling characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to ask whether one can work backwards, whether one can start from health profiling and then try to understand what kind of social issues have led to that situation.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to think of different ways that it could be reversed. One is if you look at, the health situation in the community, maybe you look at the amount of physical exercise that people typically do and where they do it. You might think of, you know, a park, for example, where you know your community members kind of regularly walk their dogs or kind of go for a run or something. That's a kind of health promoting activity or a kind of indication of how active people are, which is a kind of indication of their general health state. From looking at sort of the activity they're doing, you might be able to speculate, that health activity is helping them to create a sense of community, because if they're out kind of in a communal space, enjoying the space and kind of potentially seeing each other and saying hello, that might lead to social capital. So that's one example. Alternatively, sometimes if communities are given the chance to work on projects towards improving their own health, developing health awareness or kind of attending a health facility, that sort of experience can create social capital as well, because it's something that brings the community together and gives them a sense of ownership over a particular task. So there might be a health enhancement project in a poor community which leads to a greater stock of social capital among those people, or greater kind of coherence if they're all working together on a common goal. I thought of another one that's gone.
So it's basically social capital inducing activities that are health related that can build the link between one and the other.
But then there isn't, or social capital isn't always positive, because sometimes if you have very tight networks they can be exclusive. People might suffer from social exclusion as a result of being outside of a tight network for various kind of identifier reasons. So although social capital is like 60%, 70% of the time regarded as a positive thing that should be encouraged in communities, there are kind of chartered examples where it's negative, or where kind of...
Where it isolates, for example.
Isolates, or where kind of, social expectations of kind of, maintaining cohesive relationships and kind of participating in a strong social support network with, say, with family members and friends might place too much burden of expectation on an individual who might find that because they're, expected to provide so much support, then they start to, feel stressed about it and have too much responsibility. So tight networks can be a noose in some cases. So there's plenty of documentation that shows social capital is not entirely beneficial for health. Mostly, but not entirely. Mostly it starts the other way around, I think.
From the example you worked on, I mean, this looked like a massive project. so I guess if you work down the scale of projects, there would be some questions that you were trying to answer with regards to the impacts. That wouldn't go beyond the tipping point. So if the project is small enough,
it wouldn't go
beyond the tipping point of actually having a negative effect if the project is small enough.
Okay.
So like we were mentioning earlier, a very large project that has a nationwide effect, of course, with an immediate impact on the immediate community.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm thinking of smaller projects also because if the project is not a corporate project or a national project or a large-scale one, but a community-driven project, there are a number of decision-making processes that the community engages in to actually come to the decision to carry out the project.
Sure.
That has already incorporated some of the aspects that you were mentioning.
Yeah.
For example, public consultation.
Yeah.
Even before the project has started.
Yeah.
And that already would have, for example, taken into consideration health issues, but also other social and community aspects.
Sure.
Into the construction of the project before the actual decision has been made.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we talk about that as participatory development, and it's a kind of ideal standard, I think, for urban anthropologists and people, you know, sort of social impact assessment consultants. That's a golden standard. You know, that's something that's widely encouraged. And I think in all impact assessments, there's a process of where, you know, once you've sort of predicted your impacts, you, as consultants, usually draw big tables where they put the impact, put the people that are affected, put the consequences, put the cost, and then they weight it. So they give it a weighting in terms of, you know, a particular scale. There might be, you know, good, neutral, negative. It might be that simple, but there might be five criteria or something. It might give it a number. And of course, there are impacts which are neutral or kind of don't enhance or disadvantage the community in any particular way. So that's good, obviously, because it's not signifying any kind of huge change.
No, it's just that sometimes the model itself assumes that there is a project which is external to the community, which is being brought into the picture from the outside, and then the community somehow, like some kind of chemical reaction, reacts to what is being imposed on it from the outside.
Yeah, yeah.
While if it is a spontaneous project,
yeah.
it is a process that has grown internal to the needs and to the requirements of the community, and it grows from the outside.
Yeah.
I guess that complicates the project, of course, from this model. Perspective.
That's, I don't know,
that is not something that can be sort of experimentally assessed.
You mean a project, community-led project?
Yeah.
I mean, that's those projects are kind of sort of the territory of a participatory HIA or a community-led HIA, definitely in kind of the international development literature, you know, where kind of community levels of community development might be quite low. I've seen, you know, some projects which take an HIA as part of their, or a social impact assessment as part of the community development process of building a, you know, say creating a centre or planting trees or, you know, organising a school or anything like that. And it's kind of, you know, it's a research and knowledge generation tool which runs alongside the project development as a kind of means of people monitoring what they're up to and kind of having the chance to reflect on it and build knowledge which is sort of helpful to them as they go along. So absolutely, you can set up an HIA that's almost like a diary, and a way of analysing what you know, being reflexive, as they call it in anthropology. Yeah, it shouldn't be detrimental to, you know, any positive aims of the project.
I'd just like to turn the discussion further on just focusing on this very interesting category, which you've developed, called attachment to place, and the effects this can have on people's psyche, including distress, lack of morale, demoralization, depression, or whatever it may be. Now, for me, this raises two questions, and I wonder if you've had the opportunity to address these questions either in the community of HIA practitioners or at the World Resources Institute in Washington. The first is perhaps a rather obvious one, and these are questions asked by an anthropologist for anthropologists. Mm-hmm. The first is this. To what extent do you have to develop a psychologist's expertise or consult certified psychologists, warranted psychologists, or justify your use of psychological terms, when you make these, I'm asking a question of methodology. I'm asking what is acceptable methodology, politically acceptable and practice methodology in these projects where HIAs are administered. So that's my first question for you as an anthropologist or me as an anthropologist. To what extent do we have to develop these psycho abilities and qualifications? Or to what extent are we living in a world where it's accepted that you can dip into the psychological literature,
yeah,
just as you might wish to dip into the anthropological or the sociological literature? In other words, to what extent have these concepts become a kind of common property which can be used in different ways by people, practitioners from different social science backgrounds? That's my first question.
Okay, can we stop there?
Yeah, okay.
I've got lots of pretty simple questions. Yeah, I mean, in the health impact assessment, because the dominant type of practitioner has some kind of biological or medical training, because you're talking about health conditions, you know, the social science perspective is the marginal one and the psychological one is the dominant one, because in terms of evidence, you know, you have to talk about things in clinical terms and give clinical evidence. So, you know, place attachment and identity and belonging have often been talked about by medical people or biological people, biologists doing HIAs. That's a very common category of HIA background expertise, or psychological people, people with a medical training. So what I found was that they're talking about our concepts, things like place attachment, which to me comes from geography. I know it's used in psychology as well, but they're talking about our concepts in a not very knowing way, kind of you know, giving a minimal focus to what's happening socially before the impact hits the person, and then what they're talking about is the psychosocial effects. So on entering this project, I kind of beefed up, you know, the sort of social construction aspect of the sense of place, and was the outsider in a kind of medical and psychological setting, if that makes sense. You know, I found it very difficult because I don't have the clinical training to make the health links directly. All I can do is illuminate the fact that, you know, these experiences, if we talk about sense of place as an experience, come from the domain of the social. And then there's a whole lot of psychological literature out there which is saying, oh, sense of place is a psychological thing. No, it's not. It's a social thing with a psychological or a mental or emotional impact. So I found that a very difficult bridge. And I've written a paper on this project that for the International Association of Impact Assessment Journal that went through two rounds of peer review. I positioned myself as an anthropologist that by coincidence was recruited to work on a health impact assessment, because in the engineering company they think, oh, anthropologist, people person, that means they can health people, okay, let's give that job to that person. So, you know, you end up wearing a lot of hats, having to kind of, you know, deal with a lot of general things you don't know a lot about when you enter one of these jobs. So I kind of tried to position myself, you know, not as a psychologist but as a social person coming up the sort of boundary area from a social perspective. But the journal editor sent my paper to three biological research reviewers who've now come back to me saying, oh, we've considered this in a public health frame, and we like the social stuff, but we need, you know, much more of a kind of clinical and medical framing of it. So I've had to recruit a public health author to kind of do that stuff for me so we can do it properly. So it's very difficult.
She's going to become a jointly authored paper.
Yeah.
That's what's being required.
Yeah.
Okay, that's very interesting.
Yeah. I mean,
which one expects in a way from your talk that the way this would evolve is it would evolve into a group, a team.
Yeah.
It would into a team report.
Yeah.
It would
absolutely.
Be team research.
Yeah, yeah.
It would be a team assessment.
Yeah. Because the reaction was, oh, this is great. It's really good. It's this cool kind of interdisciplinary area. But we're looking at this as health researchers, you know, and why have you selected social capital and mental health? Because in our world, you know, the World Bank have looked at social capital and HIV. So, you know, justify in medical terms why your focus on kind of mental impacts. And for me, it's obvious because we're talking about, you know, an experiential social domain that creates a mental response. But from a health perspective, they're like, there's all sorts of things going on here. So it's very, very difficult. So I felt
that's very interesting. My second question actually involves the word you just used, evidence.
Yeah.
Evidence, the nature of evidence in these situations. Again, yeah. What intrigued me about what you said when you unfolded on the PowerPoint presentation, sense of place, attachment to place, possible impacts on people's psychology.
Yeah.
What really impressed me was that it sounded like you would be using a qualitative methodology to elicit responses from various stakeholders in putting together your HIA.
Yeah.
Now, that's very interesting because I was just in a public unveiling of a government report yesterday, and this report, which is intriguing, has been put together very qualitatively.
Yeah.
Now, I want to ask you, because
that's great.
Of your... Yeah, well, exactly.
Brilliant.
That's what we would say. We would say it is great.
Yeah.
But the kind of books we read in anthropology on method always begin by saying, you've got to be very careful. You've got to brush up as an anthropologist because government boards, funding bodies
yeah.
in government are all absolutely hot on quantitative method,
yeah.
large, if possibly randomized samples,
yeah.
small, limited questionnaires
yeah.
administered equally to everybody.
Yeah.
In other words, no sense of individuality
yeah.
or of group action at all.
Yeah.
But you're giving the impression that actually in HIA there is a lot of room for help for qualitative evidence.
Certainly, the UK, you know, the model of the social environmental model of health that's kind of preferred in UK assessments and the Merseyside guidelines that have come out of Liverpool University stress the importance of including subjective perceptions. You know, of the population, you know, of their own health and of their community conditions, and then of this, you know, particular topical area, which is all about how they feel about where they live. So it's not just a matter of qualitatively investigating, you know, how people feel about what they live, but also documenting their perceptions of health qualitatively as well. And that, yeah, that's really strongly pressed in that model, and that's very impressive. But, you know, as I tried to convey in this presentation, I was limited by the kind of, you know, restrictions of the commissioners of this HIA proposing all these great qualitative methods. And in the end, you know, they were just my suggestions and my wishes, and the focus was predominantly quantitative based on this kind of demographic public health profile, community health profile, and the policy analysis. The only qualitative element was focus groups done not with the community but with public health experts. But out there in Britain, you know, particularly in HIA cases where people from a university do the HIA in conjunction with the community itself, there's some fantastic qualitative work being done. Really, really good.
Quality.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's acceptable.
It is acceptable.
Publicly acceptable, politically, governmentally acceptable.
It's something that I think local government know is coming into focus as being, you know, the way to really get at the heart of what the community feel and aspire to, but it's not something that they fully understand. So I think qualitative in the policy world is kind of coming into its own, and I see this in the United States, and I see this in the impact assessment profession, and in the kind of welfare, you know, sustainable communities, sort of public sector agenda in Britain and the US, etc. But I think exactly how the qualitative research can link to the policy outcomes is a kind of grey area. And I think at the moment, you know, the focus is on quant to give context, you know, not context, sorry, to give trend, information on trends to policymakers. But then I think, you know, context is kind of being understood as important, and that's where qualitative methods are coming in.
Well, that's
and I think there's this growing awareness as well of kind of, rather than just counting the number of people that are impacted by something, looking at how they feel and kind of giving the community more voice and bringing people in is kind of an up-and-coming thing. And particularly in HIA, mental health is a really kind of important domain that's kind of coming in more and more. And all of these areas require qualitative research.
That's extremely interesting.
At the moment, I'm working in the team in my think tank, so it's a really large environmental think tank, and I work in the team that focuses on sustainable transport and urban development, and I am the qualitative person. The team comprises of development economists, engineers, transport planners, architects, and its work is entirely quantitative based. I am the first soft social science qualitative person that they've brought on board, and typically in the types of projects they do are basically greening transport system in cities in the developing world, and looking at the sustainability implications of city development and construction of the built environment in cities, and they quantitatively measure the economic dimension, the health dimension, and the environmental dimension, but now they've got this new awareness that social sustainability is the next thing, you know, next kind of buzz area in sustainable development, and that social sustainability, you know, is about people. Where are the people in the development? And the kind of human consequences of all these things cannot be investigated without talking to the people, which requires qualitative methods. So I am a kind of experiment in my team at the moment, you know, trying to provide them with a framework on how to qualitatively look at social factors in the types of projects they work on. You know, so from that, coming from sort of the largest environmental think tank in America, is evidence of, you know, the social people with a qualitative approach creeping through the back door and developing their tools. But it's very difficult.
Well, that certainly is very, very refreshing and enlightening note on which to end a seminar in a world which is faced by ever more dire predictions of global warming, general asphyxiation, and the end to the human race as we know it, if not in our generation, in the generation of our children. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
You have just listened to a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled An Applied Anthropologist Among Engineers, Social Impact Assessment in a Big Industry Project. This talk was delivered by Dr. Katie Baldwin.